There's a certain kind of whiplash that shows up after you hang up the uniform. One day you're running a mission, you have tight bonds with folks that you serve with, and the sense that what you do actually matters. And then life throws you a curveball that you didn't really train for, and your body reacts like you're back in it. Your sleep gets weird, your patience gets thin, and you start pulling away from the people who actually care about you. And you tell yourself you can muscle through it because that's what you've always done. Today's guest, Ryan McDermott, knows that road all too well. He led soldiers as an infantry platoon leader during the Iraq invasion, then stepped into the civilian world and got blindsided by a major career shakeup that stirred up old combat stress. This conversation will be talking about what happens when that pressure drags a past back up to the surface, how writing can become a pressure release valve, and why tying your identity to a job can set you up for a rough fall. It also gets into the things that still hold true when everything else feels unstable. Your people around you, family, your purpose, and the decision to get support before the damage spreads. So if you've been carrying something like this by yourself, feeling alone, this episode will be able to hand you some practical ways to steady yourself throughout this process. But before we get into this episode, I want to take a moment to raise awareness for something that's important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. This organization is working to build a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor the service members, families, and civilians who are impacted by the Global War on Terrorism. This memorial serves as both a tribute to those who served and as a way to ensure that their sacrifices are recognized and remembered for generations to come. If you'd like to learn more or find out how you can support their mission, visit GWATMemorialFoundation.org. Now let's get into today's episode. Hey, Ryan, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you here.
Scott, thanks for having me on today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. Absolutely. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this conversation, and you know, we're here now. So before we jump into the conversation, for maybe aren't familiar with you, could you just give us a little quick down of who you are, your background, that stuff?
Absolutely. I'm Ryan McDermott. I'm a West Point graduate, class of 2000, and I was an Army infantry officer and served with the infantry division in 2003 during the invasion of Iraq, 3rd Infantry Division again. Post-military, I left the Army in 2006, went to business school at the University of Virginia, and my first business school was Lehman Brothers in 2008, so I was part of the last associate class of Lehman Brothers. So 1 month in my job at Lehman Brothers, it went bankrupt, and my job was in peril, and I eventually lost my job and was out of work. A lot of that triggered my post-traumatic stress disorder, which at the time it really exacerbated. I had PTSD looking back, and a lot of symptoms were evident, but that really put it into a very sort of, you know, a lot of extreme symptoms, I think, like, and so pain, shaking, sure, and all that. So I lived through that. And later on, I've worked in national security and the defense ecosystem, the Pentagon. I've done a couple tours in the Pentagon, executive service member in charge of industrial policy. I'm also the author of a recently memoir. It's called River, a memoir poet. It's a story about the combat and everything I've just talked about that today. I'm all about, you know, the reason why I'm doing this and the same reason we talked before, earlier, is sort of be a conversation amongst veterans and family members as well. Understanding that the hardest part of war is, you know, times the aftermath, trying to find purpose and all that stuff.
So. Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that you touched on, you know, kind of that joss and that PTSD coming back in, you know, anyone who has a job or even just transition careers, they understand that it can be a very stressful time. And stress is one of those things that can bring on some of those triggers, depending on kind of what has gone on with that particular individual. So, you know, as you're talking, I could imagine some people, well, how could a job loss or something like that trigger PTSD? And so I wanted to touch on that real quick, just because, like, any kind of stress, it could be relationship stress, it could be job stress, it could be, you know, any number of different things that can trigger that. And sometimes you even realize that it's being triggered until like, oh crap, here it is. Yeah. And, you know, now you're dealing with it. So I just wanted to touch on that real quick before we moved on here. But, you know, so you were in the 3rd Infantry Division in Iraq, and obviously those were impactful to you, good, bad, indifferent, whatever. Like there were certainly some experiences there that you had. Tell us a little bit about that experience for you and how that went for you and kind of some of the, you know, good or bad, whatever might have come from that.
Well, you know, my experience in the 3rd Infantry Division was one of the fondest, you know, times of my life. I really enjoy, I think everybody that serves in the 3rd Infantry Division is known as the dog face soldiers, the Rock of the Marne. Everybody who serves there is very proud. So there's that part. And I had a lot of great soldiers. I was a platoon leader in charge, you know, 30 something soldiers for almost a year and a half. It was awesome. And I took them into combat. And so, you know, one of the things that there's a lot we could talk about during that period of time, but the Iraq, my career in the Army was the Iraq invasion, the preparation, series of different training events that we did that culminated with the National Training Center out in California. And we trained for the objectives that we were, it was like notional. It's like, okay, here's a highway. If you go to this way, it's a swamp. If you go this way, it's a swamp. And we expect the enemy to have a bunch of stuff at the end of it. And we all died in this notional battle. And it was kind of like, what are we going to be facing? Right. And we, you know, so we did that, and we went to Kuwait, and we got the plans. And so there's a lot that I talk about there, because you deal with family separation. And my book goes into this. It's not just the combat, it's the family part, the separation, and dealing with all those emotions that every soldier deals with when they're separating from family, but then focusing on the mission.
Yeah.
The book, and I want to get, the culminating thing was, there was several different objectives that we had to take. My platoon, we were going to be responsible for. One was the bridge over the Euphrates River. Mm-hmm. That's where the Army crossed. It's called Objective Peach. My platoon was going to be the one to actually be the first to cross it. I knew because of the way the operations orders came down. We also were tasked to be among the first to take the airport. And so the bridge fight is a centerpiece of my experience in the book. It's a metaphor, the river metaphor throughout. And it has a literal meaning in that culminating chapter where, you know, we basically came up on the bridge. We had to do a whole bunch of different operations that we had to take. And then we got, you know, the Iraqis blew up one side of the bridge before we could cross. Fortunately, the other side was trafficable, but the enemy sent over a truck right before. And so we had to like basically push it out of the way and clear the far side so that we can continue exploit and move forward. That moment, when I go through the anticipation of it, weeks really, and then the execution of it took seconds. Mm-hmm. And the aftermath way, because you deal in combat, we were on adrenaline for 3 days, you know, 3 days straight, you know, after weeks of sort of, you know, and that's kind of what it is. It's like, wait, intense battle, boom, you know, wait, you know, you sort of refit. But the assault into Baghdad from around March 31st, I can't remember, April 3rd, was basically a nonstop sequential operation. And so anyway, I'll pause there. There's a lot we could talk about with the book.
Sure.
You know, a lot of the writing was contemporaneous. So this is not me just writing this from memory. This stuff was written years and years ago. Same all the way through the Lehman collapse. That's where the bookend is. And I've basically spent 15 years refining it. So,
yeah. And one of the things that you were talking about just was the anticipation building up to whatever the operation is. And I remember that type of anticipation when it's like, there's a big unknown going on. Like you can make the best plan in the world and you can plan for all the contingencies, but there's going to be something that you just didn't think of, and you know, it's going to happen, and something comes out of the left field or whatever. And you're anticipating that. And it's like that ball of knots in your stomach or whatever. It's just like that feeling that you have just before you get into it. But once when you're in it, it's the adrenaline that carries you through, and yeah. You're riding that high of that adrenaline going throughout. And then you said there was like 3 or 4 days that you're leading up to, you know, going into Baghdad, you know, pretty much nonstop. And for anyone been in any sort of fear fight, like 5 minutes is too long. Yeah. So that, and then you end up with day after day after day, you know, pretty much continuous. That's a lot. And, you know, having that kind of experience, on top of all prior to it, it probably changes you in some ways that at the time you may not realize, but then afterwards you talked about, you know, losing your job and other things where maybe there was, and this is me, I'm not a psychologist or anything like that. So this is just me being another grunt, just trying to think through, you know, what was going on maybe, but you know, at some point you had probably some safety and security in your life as far as your job and all that goes. And then that gets taken away. And then it's like, oh crap, where's that safety blanket that I had at one point and now it's gone. And that might just be, you know, a bit of a panic inducing moment. And that could, you know, really mess with some people. So get all of this stuff. Like it's pieces are starting to fit together now as far as I'm listening to your story here. And it's interesting hearing it from, you know, one person's point of view, and to your point, you know, this was the story that you wrote is not just a from memory type of thing. This is something that been written years ago and refined over the course of time. And you know, when I wrote my book, that it was very similar to that. I started off with just notes years ago, and then eventually I turned it into something that became a book. But you know, I know, you know, things like as far as you were concerned, things that you were talking about as far as challenges of, and you know, maybe even, you know, career issues and stuff like that, you know, that's something that a lot of veterans deal with. For you, what were some of the things that helped in that transition period, getting out of the military, getting into the corporate? And I know there was some school probably involved there and all that kind of stuff, but you know, what helped you in that transition, and what helped you as you were making that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, and one thing I thought about this, because there's a lot of things I did wrong, but it was like I wasn't doing right. Mm-hmm. We didn't really have the tools. So if you think about it, I got out in 2006, and if you kind of lay out the map of it, it's kind of a relatively early wave of combat veterans from the global war on terror, especially from Iraq, right? Mm-hmm. Going out into the sort of back into society and going to business school. So there weren't a lot of combat veterans that were out in the corporate world at this point. Not, I mean, you think about it now, we've had 20 years of combat veterans kind of coming out. When I first went to business school, we were kind of, I was first wave to go there, maybe 1 or 2 years because of thing of when you can go. But the thing is I think connectivity to other veterans, right? And I, there's a couple in my class in particular at Darden, the University of Virginia. One is Eric Tuning, on to be a very successful aerospace and defense executive, very good friend of mine. You know, in terms of just being, you know, sort of being there if I've ever, you know, sort of whatever is going on. And Chris Ix, there's another Army guy. So the Army veterans of business school with, right, were great. And then there were some civilians. I think, well, what I found challenging though was I was wanting to kind of tell my story back then, and I had PTSD. I mean, it was clear I had, looking back, like I was adjustment issues and so forth. And I think a little bit of a divide there. When I went to Wall Street, I lost all the connection to the combat veterans, all of them. You know, we all went to different everything different. The guys who were veterans in the banks, right? They were all people who, they didn't serve in combat, except some of the Vietnam era guys. Sure. So when I was at Barclays, one of the older bankers was a guy, he was actually a descendant of Ted Roosevelt. I think it's Ted Roosevelt IV. And Ted was actually a very, and I haven't checked in with him in years, but he's a very strong advocate for veterans at that firm at that time. And he was great. We had lunch a couple times. And so, you know, the one thing for veterans, I mean, now what really is helpful is really, you know, there's a time where I reconnected with all my veterans, the guys I serve with on Facebook, mm-hmm. we didn't really talk about like things, like issues that we were having until, you know, even when I, you know, I met my driver or reconnected with my driver from Iraq. My driver from Iraq was a PFC at the time, I think Nate specialist, and while I was there, and then I went a different way, and then years later I found out like he had, you know, blown up by an IED and lost three of his limbs. He is a triple amputee, Louis Rosa, and we met up in Washington D.C. after I had hit a lot of challenges. Seeing him and seeing how optimistic he was, it just was inspiring. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a moment where I started to realize connecting with my, you know, my brothers who I serve with in my infantry unit and just staying in touch and just being like, you know, everyone's kind of, is wrestling with something. One of my other fellow platoon leaders. And so this is kind of an interesting thing. You know, some people think, oh, this is just something, you know, everybody, it's not a rank specific thing, you know?
Right. Right. You know, the other day I was actually talking to someone. He was a one-star general when he got out, and he was talking about the difficulties that he has transitioned out of the military and the careers that he thought were going to be available to him and just they weren't. And so he ended up feeling like he was working his way up from the bottom all over again and reinventing himself and starting over again. In a way he was, but it was just really interesting to hear that it's not just, you know, the lower enlisted or any enlisted, or it's everybody all the way up to, you know, the general officers.
Yeah.
It's really a widespread issue, and forget about rank for a minute here.
Yeah.
It's military period. It's that have to deal with it. And so part of that is what you were just talking about, is having that connection to other veterans, whether they're people that you serve in combat, or it's people who, like you, went to school with some of them, and you know, maybe they weren't necessarily the guys that you served with in combat, but you made those connections, and you had some other connection and bond that you were able to, you know, take away from that as well. So at the end of the day, having that connection is probably more beneficial than not in most cases. I'm not go out and get a battle buddy like that, because you know, some people it's just not the right thing for them. But I would imagine in most veterans' cases, it's probably going to be the right thing. Now, I want to get a little bit more into your book. You started talking a little bit about it, just a little bit. Again, the book, Downriver, Memoir of Warrior Poet. You talked about how you had a lot of stuff written years ago, and then you kind of refined it over the course of years. Was that kind of like a therapeutic process for you over that time period, or was it something like force yourself to do, or maybe both?
Maybe both, but there was a part, there was multiple aspects. One, just documenting what had been done. But then as I was doing it, it became a very therapeutic thing, right? I was having nightmares about, you know, like different scenarios and so forth, getting blown up and, you know, various types of things going on. And so writing was definitely a way of therapy. And I mean, there's more science. I'm not a psychologist or anything like this, but I think there's an aspect of like replaying something enough where it becomes kind of like you're able to kind of, I don't know if it's disconnection, but you're able to kind of rationalize it where in a way where it doesn't have the same impact on you. Mm. You get calmer. Those whatever those triggers. I mean, the things that kind of trigger the anxiety.
Sure.
But it was a therapeutic process. So to kind of summarize, like the writing process is actually, I think, kind of interesting. It's like, you know, when I was at West Point, I began writing a journal. And the journal that I wrote was actually became a cathartic process dealing with my high school senior year. During my high school senior year, my parents divorced. We lost our house. And I basically became homeless. My mother dealt with a very difficult crisis of her own. She ended up hospitalized in that process. And I had my best friends.
Oh, okay.
I finished out high school. And my family kind of structure foundation broke apart. I didn't have a structure. So when I was at West Point, my family's friend's family was, they provided that support and security. And I wrote So I began to write based on that. I began to explore my spirituality, and I became, you know, became a Catholic, largely because of the family was Catholic, and they took me to, you know, we did church every Sunday. So fast forwards, I didn't really write that much after, you know, I wrote a little bit after West Point, but there was a gap. I go to combat, I basically go to war, and I get back. And when I get back, I start processing. I start writing again. Mm-hmm. And I write. And then I did my last assignment. I did rear detachment, did some more writing. And then I realized in real time, I was like, we were experiencing things. Losing soul is traumatic when you're dealing with, when you're with families. We just had the anniversary of two troopers that were in our squadron, Minsoo Choi and Landon Giles. I will never forget their names. I mean, these are heroes that gave their lives for our country. And so I was processing stuff in real time at that point. When I went to business school, I stopped writing for a bit. But then I started experimenting. I had some courses where I was able to write like a screenplay. I wrote and I used a lot in reflections and for leadership courses. And what ended up happening is I started to cobble together things into almost a manuscript, very raw. But then, you know, life happens and I've got to go get a job, work on Wall Street. And so that it sits on the back. Mm-hmm. And then I go to, then the whole Lehman Brothers experience happens. I lose my job. I'm out of work. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do. And I start writing. I start writing every chapter, really structuring. And I poured myself into it. It was a way of just coping with that stress at that moment. And I pulled together every single chapter. And this was in 2008. And then I eventually got another job. I landed somewhere. But, you know, there's some circumstances there, you know, but didn't work out. And I ended up having to move out of banking. Banking was a lot of hours, and it weighed on my family. That's all in the book.
Sure. Sure.
And then what happened is I kind of wrote that what ended up happening is the manuscript I had in February of 2009 basically covered 95% of what is now the book.
Okay.
There is a prologue, or an introduction, and then there's an afterword that capture things, other things.
Okay.
And so it just iterated countless times. Anyway, it's very mundane. I apologize for going into all the detail, but that process of iterating in a creative thing helped me take it from catharsis to something where I feel like it's enriching. And that's the point of the book. That's the point of your story too, I would imagine.
Sure.
I'm not familiar with your book, but the warrior poet thinks more introspectively, deeply about things. Mm-hmm. And that's the meaning of things. And so taking that and creating something out of it that others can understand, I think is a very powerful thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And writing it in a way that other people can understand, people who hadn't experienced what you experienced, whether they had served in combat or not. You know, I've served in combat, you served in combat, but I wasn't where you were. So I can't experience the same things that you experienced. You have to be able to describe it to me in a way that I'll be able to understand what it was that you experienced, the things that you saw, the things that you smelled, the things that you did, all the stuff that went on. I don't know, because I wasn't there. I could probably imagine some of it. I probably could imagine some of it better than maybe someone who'd never served ever. I don't know for sure. And so, you know, anybody who's going to pick up that book, you don't know who it's going to be. You don't know if it's with zero military experience whatsoever or someone who had experience. And it could be any of those people or anyone in between. And, you know, they still have to be able to take away something from that same story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, it feels like that's a hard thing to do in and of itself. But one of the things that you were talking about is how, you know, the people who are writing these types of things are different and things. And one of the things that I in writing is that I could tell you a story right now verbally, and I can, you know, get the words out, and I can talk and talk and talk. And I can talk almost at the speed of my thoughts. And so I don't give my thoughts much time to catch up or anything like that. And so when I'm writing, though, whether it's paper or even typing, it takes a lot longer to write than it does to mm-hmm. speak. And so you have no other choice than to let your mind kind of wander for a little bit. And it's still stuck on whatever it is that you're writing about, because you don't want to go too far off the tracks there. And so you get a little bit deeper when you're writing of, mm-hmm. you know, thinking about those types of things. At least that's been my experience anyways. And yeah. some other folks I've talked to as well. And so you start to process things differently than you would if you just talked about it. So I know a lot of people go to therapy, you know, myself included, and mm-hmm. go to, like, you know, talk therapy and that type of thing. And it wasn't until I actually started writing about the events that took place that things processed a little bit differently. And I'm not saying it's, you know, 100% better or anything like that. It's just different. And, mm-hmm. and you start to remember certain details that maybe you might've forgotten about, or, you know, other things might pop back into your head and like, oh yeah, man, I forgot all about that. And, you know, just the way you write might just be, you know, a way to get yourself into, you know, a little deeper in that journey. And it's, to me anyway, pretty interesting. And so as you were writing, you know, did you kind of find that yourself, like that some of that was coming up?
You're spot on, and you're triggering a lot of thoughts about the writing process. So mm-hmm. when, you know, when you're talking, you don't necessarily, so for me, when I tell a story cold, I don't know what logical gaps I'm leaving for the person who's listening to it.
Sure.
Because I'm automatically filling in the gaps in my own mind. Right. Yeah. And so it's hard, you know, this is the hard thing, especially if it's a really intense experience and you're reliving it, you know, as you're telling the story. There's a lot of things you're seeing in your mind and you're trying to translate that. Now, I don't know if I'm actually probably better at writing my thoughts than speaking my thoughts. So one of the things in my writing process, if you take a look, and I still have old manuscripts, the first, what happens is, like, I was writing for myself when I first started, just for myself. Mm-hmm. And it's like a guidepost that kind of, it's like, oh, okay, but I'm filling in automatically. So if a person tried to read my early writing, they're like, I don't really understand this. Like, here's a question I have. You know, what did it look like there? Oh yeah. Let me describe that now. You know, because right. I've already got that picture in my mind.
Yep.
And so when you write, I think and this is something for veterans, if they're interested in writing, I highly recommend this process of just write to write. Step back for as long as you need. Mm-hmm. Leave it on the shelf. Come back to it. Look at it. Figure out if there's an arc that's like, I mean, this was something later on I did, was to kind of really structure it and say, well, here's the actual arc. I wrote everything down. It doesn't make sense if you put everything into a story. You've got to kind of trim it down to only the things that advance the plot of what you're trying to capture in your story arc.
Yes.
But everything you were just hitting upon, you know, about, you know, the process and thinking more deepens. I started adding like dialogue along the way, describing the scene, setting that up. What are the smells? Cause I didn't do that in the first iterations of my manuscript. It was pretty basic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, and those things start to come back to you as you're writing. I found anyways, is you start to remember some of those things. Mm-hmm. And you know, good or bad, I don't know, you know, depending on the situation, but it does help you kind of, I think anyways, process some of the stuff that you've gone through. Now, I want to kind of jump around a little bit here and mm-hmm. Kind of go back to that time back in 2008 when you lost your job and you noticed some of the PTSD symptoms maybe intensifying, for lack of better words, at that point. What was it for you that you did yourself during that time? You know, a lot of people struggle, don't know where to turn or what to do, and maybe that was you as well at that point. But what did you end up doing, and what did you find that was the most helpful for you at that point?
Well, it took, to be candid with you, Scott, I wasn't coping well back then, but I think it's important to talk about that. So what happened is, so 2007, it's good to talk about the story. So 2007, mm-hmm. I did an internship at Lehman Brothers. And anybody around that time knew that was a height of the market. Everything's going great. I don't know if the iPhone came out that summer or not, but I remember that it was like an interesting, it was like kind of a transition year where like a lot of great things were starting to happen. But there were little signs. Bear Stearns had a fund blow up. There was some issue, like there were some issues in the sort of investment, like subprime mortgages starting to show, didn't ripple through the banks yet. So I go back to business school after my internship. I get a job offer. I accept it. And it comes with a lot of money. So I accepted the job offer, got the money, and that helped me pay for my basic living expenses during my second year of business school. I didn't have a choice. I had to go. So Lehman Brothers is going bankrupt. I have a job there. I moved to New York City with my family. We start in August. I can't control. So I think one of the things that's I've learned now that I think I was doing then, this was something I was doing, was like focusing only on what I could control. Mm-hmm. Things I can't control, focusing on things I can control, which is to pass my test that I had to pass. Accounting exams, different certifications. Those were things I could control in order to keep my job, because they were basically laying people off or whatever. If you failed at your accounting exam, you were out. You failed the certification exam, you were fired, or you know they let you go. So the coping mechanism, I mean, I think making sure you're getting good sleep. But what happened is once down and it looked like okay, because what I had to do was rotate through different groups, and so you don't really have like a spot. And what was kind of clear is that the bank was going to reduce the number of spots that the new associate class was going to fill. So they hired for like a booming economy. 2008 is not a booming economy anymore. And so it was like musical chairs. You got to find a seat and before other people do and sit down and take it, because otherwise you don't have a job.
Right.
And that actually happened to me. And so some of the symptoms I had was I felt isolated. I started having insomnia, nightmares, I had like hand tremors and stuff because it was like very stressful, because I was facing a situation where I didn't know what would be offered, and there were no jobs at that time. It's not like you could, everyone was cutting. Mm-hmm. Where do you find a job if every company is cutting jobs?
Right.
Especially in the world of finance. And so now let me jump ahead. There's a lot I kind of leave for the imagine in terms of between 2009 and 2011, I had a sort of a collapse in terms of my career and family life. I ended up separating from my wife. And so I don't go into all the details. There's some in the prologue, the sort of introduction that kind of tees that out, but there's a lot that's not necessary. What I realized, Scott, was that I needed help. I'm an infantry guy, went through Ranger school, and there's a sort of morbid, right? Like, you know, you're going through the woods and you're looking for somebody else who's sucking worse, because you're like, this is really hard. This sucks. And the only way I'm going to like survive is if I see somebody else that's sucking worse. And at this point, I didn't get that sense. So I was like, I hit a point where I was like, man, I got to talk to somebody. I got to like, you end up talking, if you're talking to someone about your problems more than you should be, and it's affecting your relationships, you need a therapist or a counselor.
Yeah.
And so I went, dialed some guy up, and it's in the book, you know, about how that kind of happened. So my book structures counseling sessions is like these marker guideposts through the story. That process is real. I kind of had to re-script. You know, it happened over a series of multiple, like probably 15, there's only four or five scenes where it kind of lays it out. And so I think that was a big thing, is just sort of having that humility to say, you know what, I need help. I need to talk through this, and to really kind of begin to get that sort of feedback of what's going on. Because I'll tell you, Scott, at this point, I didn't want to say I had PTSD.
Right.
I mean, all this stuff is happening, and I'm just, you know, it's like, well, I don't want to, you know, it's like, I'm going to muscle through it. That's the army never quit mentality. And so moving further has taken me a long time to kind of get to it, is there is a sort of, you know, for me, it's my personal faith, surrendering. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to surrender, let go. and just and have, you know, I don't know if that makes sense, but you know, for me, the purpose for me, you know, when I was serving, it was about the mission. And I made this fatal sort of mistake, was to think, okay, I'm a family man. My purpose is to provide for my family. I have to get a good job. I have to make a lot of money and provide the best life for my family.
Right.
Now, the problem with tying of that, and this is something I would caution anybody with, is when you tie your identity with your career, well, guess what? Bad things happen. Your career may go off the track. Well, guess what? Your whole identity is collapsed because it was tied to your career.
Right.
And so for me, the sort of reckoning that I had in 2010 and 11 forced me to say, you know what? My purpose is my family, my children, and most importantly, and I need to be the best possible father I can to them. Mm-hmm. Because they're always going to be my children, and that purpose is always going to be there. They're going to love you no matter what, and they don't care what job you have. They don't. Right. Right. And they don't care. They really don't even care like how much you spend on them and all that other stuff. What they care about is that you love them, you're present in their life, and you're there for them when they need you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And as you're talking, I was thinking to myself that, you know, you have to maybe find something that identity to that can't be taken away from mm-hmm. you know, like your job. If that's where your identity is, that could be taken away from you. You could get fired, or the business could go under and you get laid off, or, you know, something happens or you get, you know, some disability and you can't work that job anymore. Or there's a whole number of things that can happen that job is not guaranteed tomorrow. Like that something can happen and you may walk in and there is no job left to be had. And if that's what your identity is tied to, then you're really going to be stuck if you don't know where to turn to next. But if you do something like what you said and tie your identity, that's a constant in your life, you know, your kids, your family, a spouse or, you know, whoever, whatever someone has in their life. And if they don't have something, find that thing that is a constant in their life, that no one's going to take that away from you. You know, it's a thing that's just always there, you know? And so that way, should something happen, job or, you know, whatever else people tie their identity. Okay. Well, you still got that anchor that is keeping you steady. And then all the rest of it is just, okay, I'll just find another job doing something else. And I'm not to say you don't care what that something else is, but it's less important when it's not tied to your sense of purpose, your sense of identity, you know, because ultimately, you know, for someone like you, what you described, your mission is to provide for your family, and at a bank or some other company or, you know, whatever, it in a way, it doesn't matter because you're, job is to take care of the family and find that something else, whatever that something else happens to be, mm-hmm. and then be able to kind of deal with it from there. So I think that's a good, kind of a good takeaway from this, is, you know, anchoring your sense of purpose or identity to something unshakable, something that's solid, you know, a good foundation that's not going to just disappear overnight or, you know, in the next couple months or whatever. So, mm-hmm. You know, because no matter how solid you think your job is, it may not be, you know, because you never know what's outside of your control. You know, you couldn't control the financial markets. You couldn't control, you know, investments that were made or other things that had years before you even got involved with a company and now are coming in and affecting the company. Like, you couldn't control any of those things. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, why get all, you know, crazy about it?
Yeah. Stoicism. I think I wish I had gotten into Marcus Aurelius meditations a lot. Like, that should be reading. And maybe it was, and I just missed it, but like, that should be required reading for everybody, like everyone, because the Stoic philosophy for me, there's a lot that important, because like, okay, there are things I can control, things I can't control. Also just understanding like the, you know, not worrying, because like, you know, how we exist in this life. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, not to get philosophical, but it's very helpful. I think for me too, you know, for me, having a personal, strong personal faith, whatever it is, for me, having that foundation, relationships, and this, you know, relationship with family is the ultimate foundation. I think for me, my relationship with my maker is important, is probably the baseline foundation.
Sure.
And family, but then also community, you know, family, friends, because there was a time where I kind of cut off from everybody. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, you know, when you tie your identity to the relationships you have, and you build that. But what's interesting is I think you end up probably with more career success and life and contentment in mm-hmm. a sense. And for, you know, for veterans, I think one of the things is to find, as you have through this podcast and your writing, is to find that thing that ties to why you serve. There was something that we all did when we signed up. We swore an oath. We said, you know, service to the Constitution, and you can exercise service in a lot of different ways.
Right.
And doing that in a is an easy thing, and it can give you, you know, I think for you, it gives you some feeling that, you know, making a difference, and same thing for me, or at least trying for me.
Sure.
You know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, there are so many different ways that you can volunteer and continue to serve and give back in one way or another. You don't have to start a podcast or write a book or mm-hmm. you know, any of those things. It could even be as simple as, you know, coaching your kids, you know, baseball team or something like that. And, you know, it, something to give back and have a sense of purpose, sense of, you know, something that's just bigger than that. You're out there serving mm-hmm. and you're giving back to contributing to something. It's something that, you know, if I don't show up, someone's going to notice. Like, mm-hmm. what is that thing? And, you know, if the coach doesn't show up to practice or to a game or something, people are going to notice, right? So
yeah.
that's a thing, right? But, you know, there are other things too. If you have those things in your life, you know, it gives you that reason to get out of bed in the morning and that reason to, you know, put your best foot forward and plan ahead and do all the things that you need to do to get ahead in life. And ultimately, that's just going to benefit not just you, but it'll benefit those other folks who you're out there serving as well. I think mm-hmm. that it's all, you know, good stuff. And I think it's, you know, maybe lost on a lot of people, and they're just too much in their own head and need to get out of their own way sometimes. And you know, take a chance and go try to do something bigger than themselves or even to better themselves yeah. in one way or another, you know?
Yeah.
So, all the stuff that you have going on, you know, you've achieved a lot of, you know, careers and, you know, writing this book, all these types of things. And some of it was not expected, you know, career changes and stuff, maybe not expected. Maybe you exactly starting off with in mind, you're just writing, you know, for the sake of writing, like, you know, kind of like what you said earlier. Is there anything else in the future for you that you're excited, that you're looking forward to kind of?
Well, a great question. Always got to have something to look forward to, right? Sure. You know, my oldest son, so with my kids, I look forward to, you know, experiencing things and their milestones. So my oldest son graduated from West Point last year. He is okay. now a second lieutenant, armor officer down in Fort Benning, Georgia. And so in the near term, I'm looking to go down there for graduation and help him move actually to Fort Bliss, Texas, which is where he's going to be stationed. So I'm looking forward to that. And there, you know, and just seeing him continue to, you know, it's weird seeing there's a period of time as a father where you see your child become a child, you know, go from being like still dependent on you to completely independent and you become very proud of the person they've become.
Yeah.
Your son's in college, looking forward to him graduating. And my daughter has graduated high school last year. She's doing a little bit of time. So I'm looking forward to that stuff, like seeing them continue to grow into great people. Mm-hmm. Myself, you know, on a professional level, I'm actually, you know, I'm really excited. So part, it actually ties to my book in a way, because you remember I mentioned my high friend, we were on the same track team. His family took me in and I lived with him. We did work together and all this stuff. So we used to do construction demolition in high school. And then actually in the summertime, when I was in college a couple times, did demo, we would go commercial demo. We worked together and we were a great team. And we've stayed in touch over the years. He had like a different career path in banking. He went into banking too, straight out of college, and worked at Wells Fargo and predecessor banks for 20 plus years. He is. So for me, what's next is on that front is he has a startup company. It's Finopti. It's Robora Financial, and what they do, it's actually pretty interesting. And so I'm working with him on doing some business development, getting the word out about this. So I got to put a plug in.
Sure.
What's great about this is for small and mid-sized businesses, a lot of company bank accounts, they're kind of squeezed on the interest rate. They're not going to get more than nothing. I mean, depending on what you're saving, some banks offer savings, some rates, some don't. What his platform does is it basically you to connect your any and all of your bank accounts, and they create a bank account for you, and you just you can actually transfer money cash into an account and earns a higher interest rate. There's also some data analytics that they're building into so that automated. So the goal is to maximize your interest on your cash. And so I'm excited about it, and I'm excited about taking that into the aerospace and defense ecosystem, because a lot of our companies lack a lot of they're too small to have like a full up chief financial officer office where a person who can manage all the cash and make sure it's getting all the optimized interest rates. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm going down a rabbit hole on that, but I'm excited to do that. And it's kind of reconnecting to me to that friend of mine who was generous into his home when I was in high school.
Well, that's pretty awesome. And yeah, it's great when those old connections can kind of come back and come full circle, especially if there has been some time where you kind of went different paths and then eventually you meet back up, somewhere down the line. So that's pretty cool. Sounds like you got a lot of stuff going forward, a lot of stuff to look forward to. So that's awesome. Before we wrap up though, I want to give you a chance to let the listeners know, who might want to find your book or find out more about you and kind of stuff, where they can find the book and where they can connect with.
Okay, great. Thank you. So the book is Downriver, Memoir of a Warrior Poet. You can search that. My name is Ryan McDermott. If you're interested in finding that, you just do a search and it should populate. Yep. My book website is downrivermemoir.com. And there's a lot of stuff I've written, op-eds. There's also reintegration resources on there for veterans. There's some educational resources for anyone who wants to teach about it, because there's a lot we can learn about the Iraq War and other stuff that, from a leadership perspective and historical perspective. And then I also have a Facebook page that's pretty active with ongoing things. But the best place to probably find the book is on Amazon.
Excellent. Excellent. And I'll have links to all that in the show notes for the listeners so you can check it out. Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your experiences and your story and a little bit about your background and everything. I think it's been a great conversation, and I'm hopeful it will be helpful to some of the listeners out there. So thanks so much.
Scott, thanks for having me on, and thanks for what you're doing. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you.